Many great ideas seem simple and even obvious once a great thinker points them out. Harvard political science professor Robert Putnam didn't originate the idea of social capital, but he helped to solidify the concept in America's public conversation with his book Bowling Alone in 2000. He was the keynote speaker at Utah Foundation's annual luncheon, an event that drew more than 300 community leaders in May. This is Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Dan Bomas. Prior to that luncheon, Professor Putnam sat down with Utah Foundation President Peter Reichardt and me to talk about the idea of social capital, as well as his more recent work, Our Kids, that looks at the growing gap between the opportunities for success between wealthy American families and others who have found education and social mobility much harder to achieve.
Well, social capital refers to the connections that link us to other people. And the core idea of social capital is simply that social networks have value. The idea is so simple, I'm sometimes embarrassed to say it. But people talk about financial capital to refer to money. They talk about physical capital to refer to some physical object, a tool that makes you more productive. So if you have a screwdriver, you can repair more bicycles more quickly than without the tool. Economists talk about human capital to refer to skill and training. So if you get a good training, you're going to be a better auto mechanic than without the training. Social capital says, yes, all of those things are important, but so too are networks, the networks that link us to other people. Networks are good for people who are in the networks. So one example of that is that most people in America get their jobs, even today, more through whom they know than through what they know, which I just mean mostly we don't get our jobs through one ads. We get a job because we hear about a job that's going up, you know, down the street. They're looking for a new engineer, and a friend of mine hears about it and tells me. Or conversely, that friend tells the hirer at that firm about me, and that connection is really powerful and helps me get jobs. And we know that actually a better predictor of your lifetime income is the quality of your connections with other people and not how much education you have. So connections are good for the people in the networks. But social capital also suggests that social networks are good for bystanders too. A lot of examples of that. One is that the best predictor of a low crime rate is the number of neighbors who know one another's first name. So if you've got a lot of connections in a neighborhood, that lowers the crime rate for everyone. I live in a neighborhood, for example, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in which there's a lot of social capital. People are all the time having picnics and barbecues and sledding parties. And I'm confident that at this very moment, back in Cambridge, my home is being protected by all of that social capital, even though, and this is the moment for confession, I actually never myself go to the picnics and barbecues and sledding parties. I feel guilty about that, but I can benefit from that in those networks, even though I'm not in the networks. And there are many examples of that. And as a result, this is the bottom line, measures of social capital, that is measures of how many friends you have or how many groups you belong to whether you go to church or not, measures of these social connections are very powerful. They have a great deal of influence over the people we're around. It happens that I think people in Utah have some kind of natural sense of social capital because by all measures, Utah has the highest social capital in America. And maybe for that reason or maybe for some other reasons, Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, has now begun in Washington a major study of social capital. That's what he's calling it, the Lee Report on Social Capital. It's a great piece of work. I'm not trying to campaign for him, but it's a good example of why ordinary people as well as public officials are concerned about social capital, because if a community has a lot of social capital, it has powerful effects on the physical health of people there, on the crime rate, on the economic growth rate, on how well kids in that community do. That's what I mean by social capital, just connections with other people.
Okay.
You talked about by all measures. What tools can you use to measure social capital?
Well, a lot. One is, for example, just ask people how many friends do you have? And there are, the average American has about 5 or 6 friends, but that varies a lot. Some people have more friends than that. Some people have fewer. Another measure is to ask people how many groups they belong to, or just to measure the number of the membership rate of, you know, the parent-teacher organization or Kiwanis or, you know, the Boy Scouts, all these measures of group involvement, measures of philanthropy, how much money we give away to help other people is another measure. Across America as a whole, I'm not just speaking about Utah, but across America as a whole, roughly half of all of American social capital is religious in one form or another. I don't mean just going to church. I mean belonging to prayer groups or Bible study groups or small groups. Jewish communities often have what are called havarot, that is small groups of people who get together. You add up all those religious groups from all of all sorts, as I say, Bible study groups and so on one hand, and on the other hand, you add up all the Kiwanis clubs and Boy Scouts and so on. Those are about the same. We have about the same number of religious and non-religious organizations, so we can, and churches have been keeping track of membership for a long time, and that's another measure. There are many measures of our connections.
Since Bowling Alone was published almost 2 decades ago,
sure.
How has the picture of social capital changed? If you equate it or compare it to financial capital, I mean, how has the social capital in circulation increased or diminished, and what's been responsible for that?
Well, there are two different points to make about that. In Bowling Alone, I tracked a lot of different measures, how often we go on picnics and how often we have dinner parties and how often we go to church and how often we, you know, how many clubs we belong to and so on. And all of those measures were going down, had been going down for 25 years when I wrote Bowling Alone 20 years ago, and they've all continued to go down. So by those measures, that is face-to-face connections with other real people, whether in picnics or in church or in bowling leagues, all those are going down and have continued to go down, in some cases even faster. There's one potential counterweight to that, which is the internet and social media websites and so on. And that did not exist when I wrote Bowling Alone. Facebook, for example, was created about 4 or 5 years after I wrote Bowling Alone. So an important question is, well, have we lost bowling leagues or rotary clubs, but we're now hanging out together on Facebook and that makes up the difference? And there's been a big debate about that. Whether Facebook connections are the same or better than, you know, connections of people in a bowling league. And for a while, advocates of the internet said it's even better. It's, you know, it's the best thing since sliced bread because you can do it anytime you want to. In the last 5 or 10 years, however, there's been second thoughts about whether someone that you only know via the internet is as good a connection, is as valuable a connection, as worthwhile a connection as knowing someone face-to-face. We know that the more real friends you have, the more face-to-face friends you have, the better your health. That's a very well-established fact, that social capital in terms of real connections with other real people has a powerful effect on increasing your life expectancy. We know, however, that the number of Facebook friends you have has zero effect on your life expectancy. It's not like if you have 3 Facebook friends, you live a certain amount of time, but if you have 100 Facebook friends, you live, you know.
So my 1,100 Facebook friends don't help me much?
They don't help you in the same ways that a real face-to-face connection will have. That's right. And the most interesting evidence about this is that the guy who invented Facebook recently said he's trying now to invent Facebook too. And Mark Zuckerberg gave a lecture in which he cited the problem of the decline of real face-to-face networks And he thought it was a problem by citing data from my book. That is, he was saying Facebook has not yet solved the Putnam bowling alone problem. And I think he's right about that. I'm not totally negative about social capital on the internet. I mean, because I think there are ways in which you can use the internet as a tool to make real face-to-face connections, and not think of it as a replacement for real connections, but as a tool that may help you encounter more people, and that could be great. And I, therefore, I think in that sense, I'm not trying to, this is not an ad for Facebook, but I think Zuckerberg is right that Facebook 1.0 was not a replacement for bowling leagues, but that maybe you could use the technology to have positive effects on real face-to-face social capital.
Is there an extent to which the technology, including using social media, can actually have a deleterious impact? You know, I think about years ago Neil Postman talking about the way the fear of technology
Absolutely.
Kind of absorbing children's lives,
right.
and then there's only so much time in the day, and you end up spending less time in face-to-face interactions, or you're in relationship with somebody, it happens via text rather than face-to-face.
Right. Well, there is certainly some evidence that screen time is bad for kids growing up. But I want to be careful here, because for a long time the debate has been real face-to-face connections versus online connections, mm-hmm. and saying what's good and what's bad. I think actually in the long run that's going to be a mistaken way of framing the problem, because let me use an illustration. In metallurgy, an alloy is a mixture of two different metals. So you put brass and copper together, and I think you get bronze. And bronze has properties different from either the copper or the mm-hmm. tin. Most of our networks nowadays are alloys. That is, most of our networks involve both face-to-face and internet-based communications. I have a very close relationship with my daughter, for example. We are exchanging email and text all the time. She's a writer. I'm a writer. For much of the time, she lived in Costa Rica, and I live up in the woods in New Hampshire. We're both night people, so we connect all the time. That's real connection. But I did not meet my daughter on the internet. That is, there's a real connection as well as this internet, the
Sure.
alloy. So that means that it's wrong to contrast purely face-to-face with purely electronic connections. We need to think about different kinds of alloys. And that means some kinds of alloys, that is, some kinds of uses of internet connections may actually be quite good, including, well, let's take I recently wrote a book about the difference between rich kids and poor kids in America. Rich kids tend to use the internet for positive purposes, which I mean they use it for finding out about colleges they might go to or fellowships they might be available for, or, you know, learning more about history by looking up on the internet and so on. Poor kids have the same access, but on average, they tend to use it more for entertainment, for playing games and so on. And so it's the same technology, but it's being used in very different ways. And so next year, I'm going to publish a 20th anniversary edition of Bowling Alone, a new edition of Bowling Alone. It's going to be the same old edition, except for a new chapter on the internet. And that chapter is not going to say, yes, it's great, or no, it's awful. It's going to look at the nuances of different kinds of internet connections and ways in which they contribute to, but also in other ways in which they detract from
sure.
our social cohesion.
One of the things you talk about in Our Kids is the increasing stratification
yeah.
of society, where seems to be less social mobility, less interaction between kids from different social and economic classes.
Yes.
And what do you think is the difference in your perspective on that versus a Charles Murray or a Raj Chetty?
All three of us are talking about the distinction between the class distinctions in America. And Charles Murray wrote about it first, and he offers a really excellent description of the two Americas, the people going, some people living in a fictitious place that he calls Fishtown, with another place that he calls Belmont, and he uses that to sort of tell a story. It's actually not based on real places, but to tell a story about how we're increasingly living separate lives, and our kids are living separate, have separate futures. And that's, Charles and I often appear together because he's more conservative and I'm more progressive in my politics, but we both agree actually on the facts of the matter here. And therefore we often appear together. We differ actually, not so much in our diagnosis, but in our therapies, if I can put it that way. Charles is a libertarian. I'm now quoting him, and I know he would agree with what I'm going to say. He's a libertarian, and as he once said in a joint meeting that we were both involved in, he said, libertarians don't do solutions. So I don't think there's anything we can do about this, about the growing gap. I'm a little more pragmatic. I like to find solutions to problems, and so I'm a little more likely to look for ways in which we could begin to narrow that opportunity gap, the gap between rich kids and poor kids. But on the facts, we mostly agree. Raj is a different case, and the difference between him and me is almost entirely methodological. He uses very large data sets that he's able to get under special conditions from the IRS, so he can actually get real individual data on people's income. Most scholars don't have access to that data. Raj is terrific at using that data to identify exactly where people have chances for upward mobility or don't. And I rely on survey data and on lots of field work. All of the book, Bowling Alone, all the book, Our Kids, is based on my going to real places and talking to real rich kids and real poor kids. And Raj and I completely agree on the facts. Indeed, he goes out of his way to say that one of the determinants he finds in his research of this growing gap is social capital. And so I would say, in his case, it's the way science should work. Completely different methods ends up with the same diagnosis of the situation. One of my mentors when I was in graduate school many years ago said, truth lies at the confluence of independent streams of evidence. So when two different people following two different methods of approach come to the same conclusion, you can be pretty sure that it's accurate. And I think that's the way Raj would see our relationship. We've come to use completely different methods, and nevertheless we come to the same conclusion, which makes it more or less likely that there's something there.
In Our Kids, you contrast your hometown, Port Clinton, Ohio, with what it was like when you were in your senior year of high school, 1959,
right,
with what it's like in 2015,
right,
when your book was published. And you do that in several other places around the country. You
right.
contrast the way things worked then and the way things work for young people now. And
right.
what's at the center of your conversation in that book?
Well, let me start with the broader picture and then move to kids exactly. I mean, specifically to kids. The broader picture is that America has become much more divided along social class lines, economic lines, than ever we were. When I was growing up in the 1950s in Port Clinton, but this was true across the country, the difference between rich folks and poor folks was not all that great, frankly. And in my hometown, nobody was very rich and nobody was very poor. It was sort of like Lake Wobegon on Lake Erie. And there was no economic segregation. The richest kid in my class and the poorest kid in my class lived two blocks apart and played on the same softball fields. So and I don't mean that there was no difference between the rich kid and the poor kid, but the rich kid's family told him when he was in Port Clinton, he had to act like Port Clinton kids. I mean, his family also had a house in Florida, and they said, there you can drink champagne, but in Port Clinton, drink what the other kids drink. And so in that period, America was very much a kind of a cohesive place. And we know that in my graduating class of 1959, roughly half of us went to college, another half of us didn't go to college, but we all ended up doing pretty well. And class was not a big distinction in Port Clinton. Now, you go back to Port Clinton 50 years later, it's a classic Rust Belt town. All of the factories that were where the dads of my classmates worked in, you know, small factories making auto parts because it was part of the greater Detroit area. And they all had decent jobs, or other dads were, you know, small businessmen like my dad, or fishermen on Lake Erie. And now Port Clinton is a basket case. The factories that used to be there, that used to employ the working class of Port Clinton, are now literally ruins, surrounded by barbed wire fences and EPA signs saying don't come near. And the storefronts are all torn up. Broken windows and so on. However, Port Clinton has one big advantage. It's got a beautiful site on Lake Erie. So if you go to Port Clinton now, most of the town is a kind of economic basket case, actually, with the child poverty rates of nearly 50%. But on the shoreline in Port Clinton, there's effectively a gated community that's 20 miles long and 200 yards deep along there, essentially of all million-dollar mansions. And so in Port Clinton today, I can take you down East Harbor Road, and if you look toward the lake, toward all these million-dollar mansions, the child poverty rate in that social tract is zero. There are no poor kids in that census tract. But if you look just to the other side of the road, to the double Ys and the shacks, the child poverty rate is 50%. The kids they still all go to Portland High School, but the kids who come in from the shore, I'm not making this up, drive BMW convertibles. But the kids from the other side of the tracks drive jalopies in which they live. They're homeless, except that is a completely different Port Clinton. It's the same city, same 5,000 people, but the division between the future that awaits the kids driving the BMW convertibles from the shoreline and the future that awaits the homeless kids from the shacks is just inconceivably different. And that was not true in Port Clinton 50 years ago.
Dr. Putnam, we're about to run out of time, but I have one more quick question. If there are three or five things, I mean, with the focus on kids and how do we make a better future for them, looking at the parents, switching kind of from a policy perspective, for the parents' perspective, what are three or five things that you would ask parents to do for their kids or expose their kids to or build into the environment in which their kids are raised?
Well, look, and I keep saying rich kids and poor kids. When I say rich, I don't mean Bill Gates's kids. The upper third of American society is constituted by college-educated Americans. So if you're in the upper third of American society, almost by definition, you're in the upper third, and that's what I'm calling rich here. I'm certainly in the upper third, but actually both of you are in the upper third too. And frankly, most of your listeners are going to be in the upper third. And when I say poor, I don't mean homeless kids. I don't mean only homeless kids. I mean the lower third, which amounts to being people who have not gotten past high school. Why do I make that point? Because for most of your listeners' kids are going to do just fine. They're on the upper half of this growing divide. And I can tell them, you know, you should make sure your kids have mentors and neighbors that are going to pay attention to them. And you should spend time, a lot of time, with your kids, reading to them, especially really early. And you should pay attention to them getting advice about how to go to college and mentors about, you know, people who they could maybe over the summer get a job working in as a intern someplace. But the problem is they're already doing that. And that's not narrowing the gap that I'm concerned about. What I'm concerned about is, it's not that I resent the good fortunate. I mean, that's my own grandchildren. My own grandchildren are doing just fine. And their parents, my children, are doing all the right things. They're because they represent that upper half of the, or upper third of American society. If you're worrying about the But what I want to do is have the audience for my book are the parents who are doing fine and their kids who are doing fine. I want to say to them, once upon a time, all the kids in town we thought of as our kids. That's why the book is called Our Kids. It's because 50 years ago, when my parents said, we've got to do things for our kids, they didn't mean my sister and me. They meant all the kids in town. And if they said, our kids need a swimming pool, they weren't talking about a swimming pool in our backyard. They were talking about all the kids having a swimming pool, you know, chipping in so that we had the town high school had a swimming pool. And so what I want to have happen is to have people realize, and especially the people like most of your listeners, I think about the other kids in town as being your kids too. And think about your kids. My grandchildren are going to be better off. I mean this very specifically. My grandchildren or your children or grandchildren are going to be better off if all the kids in town do better, because that'll lift all the boats in town, all the boats in this harbor. And therefore, my children will be better off if I try to make sure that they have opportunities to interact with kids from the wrong side of the tracks. That's what I think is important for parents on this side to know, and for parents on that side of the aisles, that side of the tracks to know, on the less well-off side of the tracks. I think they ought to do a lot of things that parents that we know in our social circles are doing already, like reading to their kids and, you know, taking them on trips and even going bowling with them occasionally.
Robert Putnam is the Peter and Isabel Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, a corresponding fellow of the British Academy, and past president of the American Political Science Association. In 2006, Putnam received the Skite Prize, the world's highest accolade for a political scientist, and in 2012, he received the National Humanities Medal, the nation's highest honor for contributions to the humanities. Raised in a small town in the Midwest and educated at Swarthmore, Oxford, and Yale, he has served as dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was recently in Salt Lake City to speak to Utah Foundation's annual luncheon, and he spoke with me and Utah Foundation President Peter Reichard. Utah Foundation is a nonpartisan, nonprofit research group funded by business, philanthropic foundations, higher education, local government, and individual donations. Founded in 1945, our mission is to produce objective, thorough, and well-reasoned research and analysis that promotes the effective use of public resources, a thriving economy, a well-prepared workforce, and a high quality of life for Utahns. Utah Foundation seeks to help decision makers and citizens understand and address complex issues. Utah Foundation also offers constructive guidance to improve governmental policies, programs, and structures. I'm Dan Bomas. Thanks for listening.